Boom, we're alive, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Electric Podcast. Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined as usual by Seth Winchell. How are you doing, Seth?
Good. How are you doing, Fred?
I'm doing great. Just came back from California this week. I was down in Los Angeles, up the coast to Santa Barbara, doing a few things with Nissan Europe. They invited me down there to just test the new Leaf and do a few green living thing down in LA. I'm going to have a few posts on that in the next few days, so check it out. But if you've been following Electric closely, our coverage of the new Leaf, it's nothing heart-shattering for you guys, but still a good look into how it is to live with a Leaf for daily driving and doing road trips around Los Angeles, which is pretty cool, I think.
And the ProPilot, that's kind of my...
Yeah, I got a chance to try the ProPilot too, which is sort of Nissan's version of the Autopilot and the GM Super Cruise and all those new, more advanced driving assist system that are coming out right now. And just a few words on it. Like, I'm pretty impressed by it. It's especially the adaptive cruise control, so it goes from a full stop to whatever speed that you're cruising to. So in the heavy traffic, it's really ideal. Like so, especially in the Los Angeles traffic, which is, we got stuck. Maybe it took us an hour to do like 20 miles or something like that. And you don't have to think about it too much. You still have to stay attentive, of course, just like Autopilot or anything else. As for the automatic steering, so the equivalent of auto steer on Autopilot, I wasn't that impressed by that though. It still works fine. Like if you're taking a sharp curve on the highway, it still works pretty good. But for staying within the lane, sometimes it started ping-ponging a lot, like for no apparent reason. So you just don't want to keep it on that much, I think.
Oh, interesting. It looks like they have some work to do there. I have the Cadillac CT6 with Super Cruise right now. So I'm doing some testing in the local area, and I'm also finding it to be surprisingly good, except it'll only go in places that GM has geo-mapped already, sort of geo-fenced. So the local road, you know, the local highway here, you can only go north, use it going north, and for some reason going south, it hasn't been mapped. Mm-hmm. And but when you
so
can
maybe they just mapped the north and they were just coming.
Yeah, they were. You were following a GM car right in front of me. Yeah. I passed them and then that
didn't work anymore.
Turned off. But you know, it sucks that it's on a internal combustion engine car, because going from a electric car, even a Chevy Bolt, to an internal combustion Cadillac is kind of a pain. You know, kind of a drag. But we'll have more on both of those driver assist things in post in the coming week, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So stay tuned for that. But as for this week news, because the show, of course, we covered the news that we posted this week, and by far the biggest one was our leaked email from Elon Musk to all Tesla employees, and especially the ones building the Model 3 in Fremont and the Gigafactory in Nevada, because the very interesting email sort of gave us a very good look at the state of Model 3 production and the plan to get to that 5,000 units a week, which is extremely important as we've been hammering for the past few months now. And at the same time, it gave us a pretty good look at the state of Tesla in general. And I mean, the email itself is the object of it is the subject, the progress, precision, and profit. So that's pretty much what Tesla is starting to do right now. But we can look into more details. But I'm curious, what was the most interesting part for you?
My biggest personal takeaway was Elon's productivity recommendations. Just generally speaking, clearly he's not a big fan of meetings. I'm not a big fan of meetings. You know, this kind of constitutes our weekly meeting. You know, just generally speaking, I'm against meetings. I thought it was interesting that we got a kind of a look inside of the way things work at Tesla. They seem very flat. Like if you're, you know, a couple levels down from Elon, it seems like he doesn't have a problem with you, you know, raising concerns, you know, after your manager doesn't take care of it, going up higher, you know, up the chain of command a little bit. So that's always nice and refreshing to see from a leader. Also the acronyms, and I thought that was kind of weird. Like, why is, I'm sure that was a reference to something, you know, he got some memo with a bunch of acronyms. He's like, what the heck is this?
But I think, and it comes from SpaceX, because I remember
yes,
a while back a similar email leaked from SpaceX, and you saw that a big problem. And of course in the aerospace industry, it's full of military peoples and stuff like that, so it's an acronym heavy industry.
Oh, by the way, I might have mentioned this to you. I heard SpaceX is actually working on a DARPA project where they're supposed to bring in some, they're supposed to be able to capture Tomahawk missiles, which is, sounds insane, but okay, that's just an aside.
yeah.
Well, also that Elon's paper is going to be called the Spud. But
the Spud, is that confirmed?
No. One shaky source.
All right.
Within SpaceX.
Yeah, just a little side note for you guys. If you're following this this part of the Musk Industries. Right. But yeah, the email. So the most important, so the what we use as the lead for the email was, of course, the path to 5,000 units a week, which is actually trying to do 6,000 a week, then accounting for a margin of error to hit that 5,000 a week in June as planned for the past 3 months now, ever since they missed the December target, because that target was originally in December. So it has been pushed by 6 months now. But then since Tesla missed the Q1 target of 2,500 per week too, some people still had concern about them hitting the second quarter target. But now we have a very clear path from it. So in the email, Musk confirmed that they hit over 2,000 units per week for 3 weeks straight, which is a very good start for the quarter. But, well, two of those weeks on this quarter, and the first one was hit on the last week of the first quarter. Then, in order, the first step to get, so they're talking about 3-time production increase from now to the end of June. Well, we're talking without the margin of error right now. And the first step to get there is a shutdown that happened this week at the factory. We're not sure if it's still going on right now, because that email came out on Monday, right? Or it's on Tuesday? On Tuesday.
Yep. And, well, maybe you got it on Tuesday. It was out. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it came out the same day. I posted it the same day, I think. And it was planned for 3 to 5 days, that production shutdown. It was both at Fremont and at Gigafactory 1, where Tesla is making, of course, the Model 3 drive unit and the Model 3 battery pack. And for a while now, the Gigafactory 1 was seen as sort of a bottleneck for the Model 3 production because of the battery modules that are made there. And Tesla was looking to completely update that line. And that was supposed to happen in March. Yeah, in March, they were supposed to get the line. And so they probably, if they got it, they're probably still installing it, and that because he said that line wasn't necessary for the 2,500 per week goal, so it's still for the upgrade. And during that shutdown, they were planning some what he referred to as comprehensive set of upgrades across all the production line in Gigafactory in Fremont. So that upgrade alone, they think is going to get them to between 3 and 4,000 per week next month. So there's still a lot of ramp to go through within those upgrades, because we're still in mid-April at this point. So we're talking about a month and maybe even more, so like 2 to 6 weeks basically, that they're going to use those upgrades to get to between 3 and 4,000 a week. And then they said there's going to be another set of upgrade that is planned for late May. So pretty much as soon as they hit that 3 to 4,000, they're going to do the other big push to hit the 6,000 units. But again, now they are aiming for the 6,000 unit in order to get to the 5,000 with the margin of error that the hyperactive have been accounting for the past few missed delivery goals. And Yeah, so the rest of it is pretty, it's more directed to the employees and how to get there. And we're talking about not just the employees, but also the suppliers. And since the very beginning, like Musk has been clear that it's going to be a pretty harsh program for a vehicle program for suppliers. And the original goal for it was like July 1st, you need to be ready to just produce thousands and thousands of units per week. And of course, that didn't happen. Not saying that it's only the fault of the suppliers at this point, but now they're doing a review of all of them, and they said that they're going to fire them if they don't meet the requirements. And they're talking about the requirements is making like the 850 sets of car parts in 24 hours, no later than June 30th. So that's the strong deadline right now. Like a year later.
Yeah. I mean, well, they got to get there. It's pretty much like this has to happen.
Yeah. So maybe last year wasn't necessarily 850 parts per day, sets of parts per day, but like a year later, you have the pretty much the same like strong deadline, but this time is to get to technically 6,000 per week, but probably more closer to 5,000 per week. And in order to do that, they're also going to add a shift for the Model 3 production. So now the Model 3 production is going to go 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is pretty standard for a vehicle program of that size. I mean, if you're aiming to do 500,000 cars a year, normally your factory just runs nonstop. It's just it's more expensive to put it on hold for a while than...
Yeah, and it also sounds like there's going to be some overtime. Like people are going to be, you know, there's going to be some extra cash flow to salaried employees because, you know, you can't ramp up another shift of human beings that quickly. Although Musk does mention, if any of your friends are good workers, bring them in.
Yeah, they're talking about hiring 400 people per week for the next several weeks. So that's just on the HR department, they're hiring the recruiters. It's like it's a big toll for them.
Yeah.
And then you have to train those people and you have to put them to work fast. So there's a bunch of other things in terms of quality too. So even though we've been talking about quantity since the beginning of the podcast, now Tesla want to also focus on quality, which they call the precision actually. And they've been hammering that for a while now that Model 3 is already better than Model S and X was at that time in the production process. But as we know, like the early Model S and X, maybe it's not the standard that you should use for early production quality. So, did they say that was also better than other cars? So in the precision part, it says most of the design tolerance for the Model 3 are already better than they said any other car in the world. All right.
That's pretty high standard, especially,
yeah.
You know, I don't know if Tesla gets over-scrutinized on its panel gaps. I think probably it does. But, you know, we've seen a few of the early Model 3s coming out with some weird gaps. But it sounds like that issue has been addressed, or at least they're, you know, aware of it.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that the people only post the pictures of the bad ones. Like,
right.
So we see the bad ones. We don't really see the good ones. And we have seen good ones. Like, Jamie when he got his delivery was pretty happy with the panels. With the finish. So, we. If there's a problem, it's probably at the expectation. So the cars that were really bad that we've seen should have never gotten into the delivery room. Like it should have been stopped at somewhere. Someone should have flagged it and said, I don't think that's gonna go well with the customer. So and at one point, Tesla thought that the delivery process would actually be like the quality assurance and delivery process was going to be the bottleneck for the Model 3. And because they're just not ready for it, so maybe that's why we saw a few cars slip to the track to the cracks and not being up to the standard. But yeah, so now Musk is saying, and I quote, "Our car needs to be designed and built with such accuracy and precision that if an owner measures the dimensions, panel gaps, and flushness, and their measurement don't match the Model 3 specs, it just means that the measuring tape is wrong."
So that seems a little bit like a little bit out there. I mean, I feel like panel gaps can adjust maybe in transit. You know, like you hit a big bump in transit, and maybe one of your panels moves, you know, a millimeter or two. Like it just seems like that isn't realistic. Even if it comes off the line with perfect gaps.
Are you saying that Elon Musk is setting unrealistic goals set? You're not saying that, are you?
I would never even insinuate that. However, that's probably what's happening.
No, but then, right, so we're sticking to the precision part. Right after that, he says, I quote, "Some parts supplier will be unwilling or unable to achieve this level of precision. I understand that this will be considered an unreasonable request by some." So you're not complete all the way. You understand that it can be unreasonable. Then he says, "That's okay. There are lots of other car companies with much lower standards. They just can't work with Tesla."
All right, whatever. But I mean, you know, let's see it. I've got my car somewhere in between the factory and Birmingham and New York. So
yeah.
I'll know in a couple of years, whenever it arrives, if how true that is.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure they're going to look at it with a fine comb when it gets there.
Yeah, I hope so.
So now that we flagged it with Tesla too, so it's they're going to be careful about it. Then the third part, so we've talked about progress, we've talked about precision. Progress was mainly about the quantity. Like we said, it's about getting to that mythic 5,000 units per week. But there's also getting there to make money, because that's the 5,000 a week goal was associated with Tesla reaching a positive gross margin on Model 3 and making some cash from it, because like Elon disclosed last week or a few weeks back, he expect Tesla to be profitable in Q3 and Q4, and that's completely reliant on Tesla on the Model 3 program being profitable. And in the email, Musk acknowledged the fact that the Tesla naysayers that are very critical of the company have a point when they talk about Tesla not being profitable. So it looks like he really wants to adjust that. And he's taking some pretty significant measure to get there. So one of them is, I quote, "All capital and other expenditures above $1 million or where a set of related expenses may accumulate to $1 million over the next 12 months should be considered on hold until explicitly approved by me. If you're a manager responsible, please make sure you have a detailed first principle understanding of the supplier's quote, including every line item of parts and labor before we meet."
That's pretty hardcore. That's like when you're in a relationship with a woman and you're like, "Don't spend over $100 without discussing, because you keep buying this shit from Amazon and it makes me crazy." Yeah. I mean, makes one crazy.
Yeah, because like you said, that's pretty hardcore. Because
that's really hardcore. $1 million is a lot, though, I guess. Not really for a car company, though.
No, that's the thing. $1 million, well, it sounds like a lot, but for a product that costs $30,000, $35,000 to, well, so Musk costs, let's say it costs $30,000 to make on average, then... And you're making $5,000 a week, so just one order of parts that can easily be in the millions. So, and then you have all the other things like the services and stuff like that for running the factories at this point. So yeah, I mean,
it definitely seems like they want to tighten their belts. And when you go on down to the subcontractors, that's another area where, you know, it looks like Elon like went into the books and was like, "Why is there seven different contractors that and only one person's doing a job?" Which I think, you know, when you're really busy and you kind of just outsource something to somebody, and then they're like, "Eh, you know, I can get this company to do it cheaper," and then that company's like, "I'll just pay somebody else to do it cheaper."
Yeah, he called it a Russian nesting doll of contractors.
Yes, so that's kind of how that happens. I think the takeaway here is that they're trying to make a profit in Q3, and to do so, they're going to have to tighten their belts a little bit, kind of, you know, get their expenditures down. I don't think the food at the Model Y event is going to be very good. I think they're probably going to have like Krispy Kreme cater the event. But you know, that's, you gotta
do what you gotta do.
You gotta do what you gotta do.
But, what I was saying is that, yeah, cause
no more cereal for employees, no more free cereal.
It's Silicon Valley. You cannot not do that.
All right.
But the, so the main thing for like a few years back, or maybe just even a few months back, so the Tesla shorts and naysayers were all saying that Tesla would never get 5,000 units per week for the Model 3 program, just because they had so much difficulty getting to 2,000 for Model S and X combine. So now it's a hard argument to make, because they already got to 2,000 a week, which is 4,000 total with the Model S and X. So the path to 5,000 is a lot clearer. Whether or not Tesla achieve it within the next 3 months or 6 months, like that could be argued. But getting to 5,000 at this point, it's like I don't see it as a chance of not happening. Just when it's gonna happen. But their second thing that's short that Sarah's what been hammering for months and years, but not now, is that Tesla will never be able to make a car at $35,000 and be profitable doing it. And they still have a good argument, because Tesla hasn't even delivered a $35,000 car yet.
Yeah, you can't even buy one.
Yeah, so the Model 3 is still, what's that, like $49,000 the starting price right now if you just order it?
Yeah, stock. and then there's $1,000 delivery fee, and, yeah, you know, all that stuff.
$50,000.
So it's a $50,000 car.
But if you can deliver that and be profitable, so then the other car is going to be cheaper to make. Like the 50 kilowatt battery pack is cheaper to make than a 75.
Significantly.
So there's certainly going to be ways to get to the $35,000. So if they can already, because the way it sounds like right now, Tesla's going to get to 5,000 units per week with the current configuration. Like we reported last week, Musk said that the all-wheel drive is coming in July. And the 5,000 a week is a requirement for them to release that all-wheel drive dual motor system. Even the white interior apparently is linked to that. So Tesla is apparently not changing any available configuration until we get 5,000 a week. So those $5,000 a week is going to be a $50,000 minimum car. But like I said, with the rest being cheaper, the smaller battery pack, you should technically be able to get there. But I think like the $5,000 premium package, it has to be like a big profit. Like that's where they want to get the profit, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of margin. And there's also margin on the battery, because if we say that Tesla's at the cell level is around $100 per kilowatt hour, and you're only adding 25 kilowatt hours, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. But theoretically, it should only be $2,500 of cells in extra in the 75 kilowatt hour battery pack than the 50 kilowatt hour battery pack. And they're selling it for a $9,000 premium. Yeah,
$9,000 option. So
there's, you know, that becomes a problem though, because if they're not breaking even on the $50,000 car, then it's going to be kind of a rough time getting down to $35,000.
Yeah. But they are definitely concerns there. So that's what we're saying. They're not out of the woods here. We see a clear path to 5,000 units a week, but we're still a bit concerned about the gross margin on the car, especially once they start getting those nice new option like the standard battery pack.
Yeah, I think the all-wheel drive will sell well, but I would be surprised actually if they sell a $35,000 car this year. I think it'll be one of those things where they like the first one comes off the line Christmas. Well,
they say late 2018, so that's completely possible.
Right. I mean, it feels like they need to meet that late 2018, and they will meet very late.
But what I'm most surprised is if they get by the end of the quarter so let's say they start selling the all-wheel drive like in July, they start the delivery in August. So now like most of Q3 is going to be the current configuration right now, and they're going to be producing them by 5,000 units per week. So they feel confident that they're gonna have enough order for that $50,000 car minimum with just the rear wheel drive and current configuration with the current options.
Yeah.
You don't think that's gonna be an issue?
No, I don't think. I think that there are probably the majority of people of the 500,000 that pre-ordered the Model 3. I think probably 75% of them are base model-ish, you know, maybe with some, you know, small options, but like, you know, definitely the smaller battery pack. And I think, but I think, you know, you still have over 100, maybe 200,000 people who are ready.
Well, that's for the around the world, though.
Yeah, that's around the world. That's a good point.
Yeah, so they're still only in the US and Canada right now, which I think is going to be a bit limited, but. And by the way, for those still concerned about the federal tax credit in the U.S., there was another batch of invite that was sent out this week, as we reported earlier. So, and it was for reservation under the U.S. and Canadian delivery, as far as I know, haven't started yet. So it should start soon.
And it seemed like a big batch, too. We got a lot of comments.
A lot of reports from it. So that, right now, there's no indication that Tesla is holding back deliveries in the U.S., to get that 200,000 delivery in push it to Q3, because that's our idea right now. But we're keeping an eye on it, because I know that's a big concern for a lot of people, that that $3,500 can make a big difference. Well, I think that's pretty much it for that email, though. I think we can move on. But it's on Electrek if you want to read it in full, though we quoted a lot of the best part today.
And what else is going on? We got China.
Yeah, that was something that we discussed it a lot on the last podcast, especially with Galileo, about the importance in China as the world's biggest car market at this point, and consequently the biggest electric car market also. So we talked about the president of the country sort of softening a little bit his stance on the situation with the trade war, in quote unquote, with the U.S. But now it was made official by the National Development Reform Commission. They are removing that protectionist law that makes that forces foreign automaker to partner up with a Chinese company in order to set up a car factory in China.
For electric cars, it's this year. And yeah, for traditional cars, it's 2022, I think.
Yeah, so it's going to be a sort of a phase out of the current rules, starting this year with electric car, and over the next 4 years, they're going to have, like, I think they're going to start with electric, like you said, but commercial cars, and they're going to move toward just regular passenger car over a few years. And so,
which is great for Tesla. It's like almost written for Tesla, because they're the only exclusively electric car maker.
Yeah. It's really great for Tesla. It's that's why we wrote it like that, because the way, like, it sounds almost like the Chinese government was waiting for Tesla to give up and partner with one of their own, but they held their ground and they didn't want to at all. And now they said, well, Tesla is the only one that didn't flinch, so it's not that big of a deal. We already got GM, well, we got Ford, well, we got BMW, we got all the others, because that's what happened over the last year. All of them ended up announcing new joint venture deal with Chinese car companies for electric cars, because that ZEV mandate was coming, and it was too big for them not to get those electric cars out there and get those credit in time, because it was a big crunch on their big gas powered cars business otherwise. But Tesla doesn't have a gas powered car business, so they said, oh, we can hold off, give me that 25% import duties. We're still selling 10,000 cars a year in China with that. With 10,000 Model S and X a year, with that 25,000 duties. So they hold off, and it worked.
You know why they sell so many? It's that bioweapons air filter. Like driving through Beijing, you do not want to breathe that air.
Yeah, I think that's a good. That was a good marketing move, a good actual move too, though, because it's actually a great air filter. But the way they marketed it, it was really smart.
Yeah.
So now, what's next is that Tesla's been talking about announcing a factory in China for years now, and that seemed to be the biggest holdup. now it's gone or it's going to be gone in the next few months. So they said this year. So even if the actual rule hasn't changed, it sounds like they already had a plan for a factory, and they were especially talking about the Shanghai government to establish a local factory in Shanghai. So maybe they have a lot of things already done, already ready to go. So I won't be surprised if Tesla announced something soon.
On that front. That would be a big boost to the stock as well, I think. If it's going to build, you know, quite a few cars.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my biggest concern is already going to pay for it though.
Right. Capital raise.
Yeah, so that's what he said. He said they don't need the capital raise, but they could maybe still do one, even if they don't need one, because they actually reach profitability. But I don't think they can do that until Q3 or so. Until they actually reach the profitability, so that people believe them when they say it. And then they say, by the way, we're going to accelerate our plan, so here's a million more share on the market.
Or what about, what if they... You know, they could JV with Panasonic and do a gigafactory there. I think batteries in China would be a good thing.
But
I don't know.
If you look at the gigafactory in Nevada, Panasonic was on board, but it still costed. I think Panasonic invested $1 billion, and then Tesla invested like $3 or $4 billion. So there's still a lot of money needed. And I think with this one, what you're going to want to do is do a gigafactory for the batteries with the cars at the same time. So to just be able to produce both at the same place. So might be an even bigger investment.
Yeah.
Though they also said that they saw a lot of efficiencies with the Gigafactory. So at first they thought that $4 billion would get them 50 gigawatt hour per year. And now they're thinking about 105 gigawatt a year.
Oh, wow.
So for the batteries, I mean, for the battery pack, it's 150. So it's
going to be a Terra factory pretty soon.
Yeah, one tenth of the way there right now. And doubled it in just a year. So yeah, it's very likely. And while we're on the subject of Tesla batteries, might as well talk about battery degradation, which was a big concern for a lot of EV buyers out there. And we've been reporting on the same. It's crowdsourced data from hundreds of early Model S and X buyers, and they've been reporting the state of the current range of the state of charge when the state of charge of the battery is full after a certain number of miles driven, of kilometers actually, because many of them are European. And they've been reporting that on the Dutch forum, on the Tesla Motor Club Dutch forums, and it's been compiled by a few of the owners there. And we've been reporting sporadically on the result there, because the more they get data, the better, the more accurate it is for us to report on it. And the latest result was out this week, and it's still very encouraging, because the trend line showed that you won't get even close to 90% battery capacity until over 300,000 kilometers, which is 186 miles. Yeah, that's not right.
186,000 miles.
186,000 miles? Is that right?
It's two-thirds usually. I just round up, so it's like 200,000 miles. Yeah, so, and it's not just Tesla. Like, I would love to say that Tesla just makes the best batteries in the world, but
that's about right.
if you have a good active thermal management system, I think, and you have good lithium batteries, which I think Tesla has both, I think you're going to see similar results. It's not like a magic bullet. The problem is if you don't have a good active thermal management and you're air cooling Nissan, then all of a sudden you start to lose. Like, I think they were seeing like 20% after a year of degradation. And this has always been a problem with the Leafs, which, you know, is a bummer, because, you know, that a lot of people get their EV experience from, you know, Leaf drivers. And, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, I used to have close to 100 miles last year, and now I'm at 80 miles, and this sucks. And, you know, I think Nissan really should have spent some more time considering the thermal management of their battery packs for their new Leaf, which they didn't.
Well, I can give you some insights into that, because this week I spoke This week I spoke with a Nissan EV executive, and what she said, because I asked her that very same question, and I specifically asked her about the fact that the ENV 200 has the same battery pack, but with a thermal management system, an active thermal management system, I should say. So, and the battery degradation of it has been better than a Leaf 2, as reported by owners. So I asked her the reason why they didn't do the same with the Leaf. And what she said is that it's actually a cost reason. So she of course, it's not a technology reason, because they know how to make it. Like I said, it's in the ENV. There's nothing like, there's no technical barrier for it. But what she said is that for the use case of the ENV 200, which is a commercial van, which is used by like professionals and even like taxi companies, even use it as passenger vehicles and stuff like that, and it gets a lot of use. So they thought that battery degradation was a better, a greater care, and they get a lot of more charging. So they go through more cycles more quickly. So they thought that was more useful there. They said that it was less the case with the Nissan Leaf, because they thought that owners will charge it every few days or so, and not do as many cycles as quick, and don't need it. But then my question is just, how big of a cost is it? Because there's a big value in the battery pack, and that value is being degraded by the fact that the battery capacity is being degraded. So if you lose, like we've been saying, 10% the first year or so for most of them and something like that. So if you're going to lose 10% of a $7,500 battery pack, like that's $750 that you lose in the first year. If you could have prevented it, just half of that with an active thermal management system, that's over $300. I'll be very surprised if it's more than like $1,000 worth of electronics and equipment system for an active management system and a battery pack. Don't know about you, but
I think that's a really poor choice they made, and it's really disturbing that they knew about this for, you know, they've been making Leafs for almost a decade now, and they made the new Leaf still without it. And, you know, I almost want to think, like, is there like an aftermarket solution? Can you, like, because you know, Nissan says, well, if you want to cool down your batteries, you can turn on the air conditioning in your car, which is asinine. Yeah. But, like, you know, maybe you can actually put some sort of, like, go to a PC store and get a bunch of, you know, thermal paste and do something to cool down your battery, because, man, that sucks. It just sucks to know that, like, every time you charge your Nissan Leaf in the heat, like, you're probably taking off 2 or 3% of your battery pack.
You could do like what they did with the first Model S that did the Pikes Peak. You remember that?
They did
a nice bath to the battery pack of the
Model S. An ice bath, right? You just have one of those at the house.
Yeah,
for hot days.
Yeah, that's pretty useful.
Chevy, like, you know, they had the Volt. I don't know if the Volt is active or passive, but, you know, when they built the Volt, they were like, you know, and I talked to the guys. Chevy had an event in near San Jose, and they actually let us talk to the engineers who designed the battery pack, and we have a video up for that. But you know, they said, yeah, you know, it's crazy not to have thermal management. Like, you're gonna lose lots of range. You're gonna lose, you know, you're gonna have problems with the shorts to the system if a battery pack goes bad, and you can even have like some thermal runaway. So it just seems crazy to me that Nissan, after all these years, is still designing a passive. It's like those Volkswagen buses with the air-cooled engines that always overheat. Like, yeah, you know that's going to happen. Why don't you just, you know, pony up the $250 it costs to cool it off? Or just cool it off a little bit. Like, just pretend like you're trying.
Yeah, and if we go back to the Tesla data, I mean, just to be fair, there are some outliers data point in the data set that shows some more aggressive degradation too. And they've tried to find a reason why, like, it was the case for those one in the data set by asking other questions, especially like we're talking about charging is a big issue. So how frequent was the DC fast charging with the supercharger or any other DC fast charger that you have out there? the type of how frequent you get the full cycles and stuff like that. But those data point didn't actually end up being very useful. Like we thought that supercharging frequently was an issue. At one point, the sets showed that it actually helped the battery pack.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and we also know that if you go through a full discharge every now and again, it also helped too.
You know, didn't we see some documents somewhere that showed that certain battery packs in the Tesla performed better than others? I feel like the 90 kilowatt hour battery pack was substantially worse at retaining its capacity over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So the 90 kilowatt hour is starting to come out now. We've been talking about it for a while, but it looks like that indeed the 90 kilowatt hour battery pack for Model S and X is showing a lot faster degradation. It's not clear why, really. It's not that faster. It's not like, and we're not talking about still the Leaf kind of trend that we're seeing. But yeah, it can be an issue.
Yeah, and I think we saw it plotted out, and it wasn't just that, you know, like some weird, some outliers. It was kind of like a pattern where the 90 was losing significantly more, not significantly more, but a little bit more across the board than the 85 or the 100 or the 75.
Yeah, absolutely. It was clear at this point. And that's for Model S and X, and they don't have a battery degradation warranty on it. I mean, I think they would change, like if it's very aggressive, it's clear, like especially if you put it on that chart that we got here where everybody is like really close to the 90%, maybe Tesla would do something about it because the battery is on warranty, but there's no specific like charge capacity retention that Tesla guaranteed under the warranty. But they did it for the Model 3.
Yeah, so. I feel like that guy. So there is an outlier that he's at like 10,000 kilometers and he's at 75%. Yeah, I feel like that guy could get a new battery.
Yeah, that's probably yeah. Though Tesla guarantees 70% for the Model 3, so
yeah, but that's after 10,000 kilometers. Yeah, that's like barely off the lot.
Yes, so check it out on the check for the chart. It's pretty cool good data to get. But moving on, this still with Tesla. Well, that's gonna be our last one this week for Tesla. We're already like 40 hours in, and we're still talking about Tesla. Power Walls and Power Pack in Puerto Rico. So we've been talking about Puerto Rico over the last year because of the two hurricanes that really destroyed the power grid there. And not just the power grid, but also like the island in general. They had a tough time there. And it's still happening. They still have an issue with the power grids. I think most of the island is back online now. But on Wednesday, they had an island-wide blackout again, which happened like twice this month or over the last month. So what happened is that we don't know what happened actually for the thing that caused the blackout. It's still being investigated. But Elon tweeted out that because Tesla has been helping out with the effort to get people online with energy storage and solar. And we knew that they sent out hundreds of power walls and a few power pack systems. But the installation of them has been kind of slow, as we are, because it's just like too many projects right now, and they have to send a bunch of technicians down there. They didn't have the infrastructure ready for a massive deployment of energy storage. But Tesla ramped up the effort, and Elon Musk confirmed this week that they had 600. They had energy storage system at 662 location in Puerto Rico. So that can mean like a bunch of hundreds, a few hundreds of houses having power walls, and it can mean like a few dozens projects with power packs. We reported on a few specific ones, like on the highland of Yesquez and Culebra. We have like Tesla deployed, because they tried to, of course, start with critical services. So they started with a sanitary sewer treatment plant, a water pump station, elderly community, hospitals, like all that stuff. We also reported on a specific one when they did also a battery pack and a solar system, so they could be completely off-grid, a hospital in Puerto Rico. We also saw a microgrid. Tesla deployed a microgrid with a few dozen power walls, and solar, so that the little community could be completely off grid, even if something like that happened again, which is inevitable, really. Like we've been hearing for a while now that next hurricane season is going to be tough too. So you should really like work on the grid to be a lot more robust for next season.
Yeah, I kind of feel like if I was a homeowner in Puerto Rico and I had a few bucks, and I know money's kind of tight typically, I might go out and get a couple panels and an inverter and maybe some batteries for the house, you know, just in case the next, you know, hurricane takes out the power again.
Maybe we should work on a post on something people like. Do it yourself, but very low cost. Like not something that can run a full house or something, but still that you can plug your fridge in on it or something like that. Or
yeah,
because I know the last time that it happened, like people just rushed to buy car batteries and stuff. Like they wanted any battery they could find just to be able to run a few things on them and stuff like that. So maybe we could try to figure out an optimization of something that's relatively low cost but can still work fine too.
Yeah, and you know, if you grid tie it, you're saving money, you know, the whole time anyway. That it's, you know, it's got power. That's actually an area I've been thinking about a product for a while. So it'll be fun to put together a DIY on that.
Yeah. Now we can talk maybe a little bit about the borrowing company, because the borrowing company this week got a ton of money. And guess who invested in it? Elon Musk. So the borrowing company filed with the SEC about raising some funds, and they ended up raising $112.5 million. And a representative for the borrowing company confirmed that Musk invested over 90% of that amount. So it's not any venture capitalist, any outside fund, anything like that. It's Elon Musk investing in it, and a bunch of early employees of the company also invested in the company.
So 90% of 113 is close to 100 million, and then 13 million from
about 30 different employees.
Yeah, and then you know, Jurvetson was probably there with some cash, probably just because he's always there with the cash.
Yeah. Though in the statement that I got from the borrowing company was he said it was early employees, so I don't okay. know if Steve would qualify as an employee.
Do they have a PR department over there, or is it?
No, it was one of Elon the lieutenant.
Okay, gotcha.
His right hand man.
I gotcha.
Yeah. So far, of course. The borrowing company has been financing itself with hats and flamethrowers. it's no joke at this point, because they had millions of dollars in sales, so it was probably really a big part of the money coming in at that point.
Until they get sued because somebody caught their house on fire with their toy.
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of warning on that box on that flamethrower box.
Right.
But and there was also the new thing that was announced last month, but we haven't seen the actual product yet or any pricing, anything like that. I'm talking about the Lego-like blocks made of out of the rocks that they want to pull of out of the tunnels, and they with those blocks you could actually be able to make some structures, even houses maybe. So that's an interesting product. It's a more sustainable also line. I mean, it's not just reliant on the popularity of Elon Musk and the company itself, like with the hats and the flamethrowers. It's a novelty that wears off pretty fast.
We'll see. I don't know. The hat seems to be doing well for you.
Yeah, well, it got me the invite for right. going into the tunnels. I'm doing that. July 22nd, I think, people. So
you sure they don't just give that to press people they don't like, and it's kind of like a one-way trip?
They just seal it off after right. behind you. Yeah, I hope not.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think Elon hates us. But so now that's some real money that they have in the bank at this point. So there's three big infrastructure projects that they're working on right now. Of course, there's the one, the tunnel in LA, which is going to be the one I'm going to visit. Then there's a project in Chicago, which is not greenlit yet. The RF analyst may probably, I think that's a good way to characterize it, like the hot one of two companies currently bidding on the project. The project has been greenlit, but...
So you know what would be smart about that? I've actually flown, my in-laws live in Milwaukee, and we fly into Chicago O'Hare because it's like kind of close to Milwaukee. Instead of just making a tunnel to downtown Chicago, which is, I think, about, you know, if you're driving at 3 a.m., it's about a 25-minute drive. So, you know, theoretically, if you're going 120 miles per hour, it's probably like a 15-minute train ride. They should consider doing one to Milwaukee, where there's still quite a bit of people. I think it's a 1-million-person town. A lot of people fly in from O'Hare. And, you know, that would make my... trips to my in-laws' house much easier. So,
put it on there. Like, Jan, I want to make my trip to my in-laws' house.
Exactly.
So extend that. And so my point was that you have that, and you have the Hyperloop system, and it's going to be a loop, and then maybe an Hyperloop system on the East Coast right now between Baltimore and the Washington D.C., and they want to extend that to New York. But that's three projects, and they said that those three projects are going to be financed by the company. So it's not like they are taking public fund to make a mass transit system. They want to finance that themselves. So it takes a ton of money, of course, even though their goal is to actually make tunneling cheaper. But even if they manage to make it an order of magnitude cheaper, it's still a very expensive endeavor. So talking about digging massive holes in the ground and making mass transit systems in them, it's no joke. Right. Now, with $100 million in the bank, you can probably buy maybe a few more boring machines, maybe like two or three more, and then start having some upgrades to them.
Yep.
Having them dig in under LA to start with, because the other... So they had the one under SpaceX that was done. Now they're working on the one in Hawthorne, which they are working on because it's greenlit. They had the one in Culver City, which is still on hold at this point. But now it looks like they're making progress for the one in West Los Angeles. So this one seems to be about to be greenlit. And it's 2.6, almost 3 miles more, I think. So it's a big one. So things are moving on that front. So it's not don't sleep on it.
Yeah, it's nice to see these things actually happening. It's so weird that nobody else kind of really got into this. Like, you know, clearly there's traffic problems in LA. Like, nobody disputes that. And going up is, you know, airports and whatever. But why is Tesla the first, or not Tesla, but why is Elon's Boring Company the first company to try to dig underneath the freeways? It just doesn't seem like... It seems obvious in hindsight, I guess.
Yeah, it does. But it does and doesn't, because I think a big part of it is like the very simple idea of combining, of not letting cars drive into those tunnels. Like, I think that's the big difference. Because what makes it a lot cheaper is the fact that they can just bore one hole through that boring machine, so the boring machine just have to go one way, and then it's done. But if you do that, you cannot put a full car lane in it because of the width. But if you put that car or whatever kind of vehicle, in that case, they call it like electric skates or whatever, you put that on rails, then the diameter of your tunnel can be a lot smaller. You can just have one go at it, and it's a lot cheaper. So I think that's the combination of those two. Not that it's like it's pretty close to a subway too, so like subway is similar. So it's not like it didn't exist at all. But
And even LA has some subways now.
Yeah. But we're running out of time, so we're going to try to...
Yeah, so 10 minutes left. Let's talk about VW, Porsche, Audi.
Yeah, we're going to go pretty fast right now. So just a quick mention that Porsche is making some moves for the Mission E ahead of the launch next year. They started this week taking reservation with deposit in Norway. Have we been talking like in the past few months now that all the big automakers that are coming out with electric cars in the next few years... already turned to Norway for reservation because they know it's a big market. Everyone is looking at it right now as an example for the future of the auto industry, because they already has over 50% of new car sales being electric. I'm talking about electric and plug-in hybrids, though. But it's going very, very fast. They want to be all electric by 2025. new car sale, I mean. So Mercedes, Audi, Jaguar for their car coming out this year, next year, are already taking reservation. That's been for the past few months, really. And this week, Porsche added itself to the list with 20,000 kroner to get their reservation. What freaks me out the most about it is that they haven't even confirmed the price yet. Like, I have no problem with people like asking for a deposit for reservation, because I think it builds diamond for electric car, but I want to know the price before I'm going to put $2,000 for a...
The price is, if you have to ask, this is not for you.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, it's not even the case. I mean, they're talking about the reports that came out, which are unconfirmed at this point, is that it's going to be very similar to the price structure of the Model S. So starting at around $75,000 with three different trims for the performance, pretty much like a Model S. So it's going to be, should be, and it's not like the Model S is not popular in Norway. I mean, it's
I think it'll be interesting to see. I don't know if Porsche will be able to hit the Model S pricing, though. I think that's optimistic, at least initially.
We'll see. We'll see as soon as next year. And still on Porsche, the other interesting thing now for the North American market is that they're talking about making their own charging network of 500 EV charging stations across North America, partly with the dealership. So about around 200 dealership will get the stations, and the rest will be on highways. So we're talking about a pretty significant network here, and we're talking about a network with Porsche's 800-volt charging technology, which they claim can be charged up to 350 kilowatts, which would be the highest charge rate of any passenger car to date. So the big news about that is that Porsche, the way they were talking over the last few years about the Mission E in North America, it looked like they're going to rely on the Electrify America's network, which is the one that Volkswagen has to do because of the settlement that they got over their cheating scandal in the U.S., but all over the world, but the settlement in the U.S. was for them to invest heavily in EV charging infrastructure. So it looked like... Porsche will just... Porsche, by the way, is a Volkswagen company. That's why I'm saying that. It would just ride on that effort and not do their own network. But now they say that they're gonna separately do their own network on top of it, which is great news. I mean, it's just more EV infrastructure. And I know you've been talking about that, about automakers using their existing dealership network as part of EV infrastructure.
Yeah, I was going to chime in with that. Like, why doesn't Chevy just do that? Mm. Like, they would have so many more places to charge. And, you know, it's kind of interesting now that, you know, we'll transition to the Electrify America network post now, but it's kind of interesting that it's VW's Electrify America, but if it was strictly for VWs or even, you know, the larger Audi, Porsche group, they would only have CSS chargers, but it looks like a lot of the charging stations are going to have CHAdeMO as well. So it's not specifically for VWs.
Yeah. I'm the one calling the whole team because they are the one that's running it. But
right. And they also, part of the branding is, you know, Electrify America by VW Automotive Group or whatever.
Yeah. Definitely. But yeah, going to that news, so what happened this week with Electrify America is that the unveil, if you will, the actual charger, the design of it, and the fact that they're going to be made by four different companies. So they have four different chargers. They have the same like design, similar design for each four of them, but they're going to be made by ABB, which is like the giant Swedish and Swiss company, like a giant company. BTC Power was also known as a big charging station manufacturer. EFEX, whatever.
Yeah.
And Signe. They are all going to be making their own station. So it's a huge 2,000 station project. So they're going to split them between all four manufacturers, which I think makes sense. You don't want just to overflow one manufacturer and put the other one in trouble for such a big network, which they have to do too.
But what's interesting is each of the chargers are a little bit different. Like the ABB one has both CHAdeMO and CSS. And I think the CSS is at 150, CHAdeMO is at 50. But the Cygnet has just CSS. It's dual CSS, but it goes up to 350 kilowatts, which is impressive. And, you know, if you're one of the six people with a Mission E, you know, you'll get a fast charge at that. Mm-hmm. The EFACUS one, whatever, has, I think, 50 CHAdeMO and 150 CSS. And then the BTC Power also has CHAdeMO at 50. And, you know, it's hard to read from the thing, but I think it's 150 on the CSS.
Looks like.
So, and it's kind of weird because they all have, I think they're all going to have different charging, different ways to pay for it.
No, or, no, they said it's going to be all streamlined.
Okay, so it's all going to be one system because it looks like, you know, just from the press release images, like one looks like it has Apple Pay and the other ones look like they have, I mean, they're all just different looking, but I guess if you have one card that's got the...
Yeah, the hardware might be different, but at the end of the day, the user interface is going to be the same.
Yeah, that's good, at least.
And the other news for Electrify America this week, after just the next day after they announced the partners for the hardware, they announced a partner for a location. So Walmart is going to get over 100 locations. So over 100 Walmart stores is going to get those stations.
So that's good in that, you know, Walmart is somewhere you can spend 20 minutes to a half hour. You know, it's not going to be the best food, clearly. It's not going to be the best shopping experience ever, clearly. But it is something to do. And, you know, there's 100 Walmarts across the country, I'm sure, and strategic charging spots. You know, clearly it would be better to have them at, you know, Whole Foods, where, you know, Tesla's partnering with Whole Foods quite a bit. There's a bunch of higher-end places that would be nicer. But
what I was saying in the post, too, is that normally Walmart is not like, you don't have a Walmart and just a field around it. Like, normally they are in pretty commercial spots. So
right.
You could normally walk down the street and get a few other of your stores and stuff. So I don't think it's going to be a bad situation. I'm more concerned about, because those fast charging stations are for normally enabling long distance travel mainly. So hopefully they are close to highways or close to like popular routes, stuff like that. So it's not, you don't have to like make a big detour to get there.
Right.
So,
and strategically placed too. Yeah. I mean, you know, I just took this trip to Florida and sometimes you have to drive off the highway, you know, 10 miles to get to a supercharger. Idea. And sometimes they're at, you know, just like the station, you know, the restaurants that are on the side of the road that you don't even have to get off the highway for.
Mm-hmm.
And those are clearly, obviously, way better for travelers. And, you know, frankly, like the people who are going shopping at Walmart, they're not the people who need a quick charge. Theoretically, they live in the, you know, close by. Yeah. And they probably charge at home and start every morning off with, you know, even the low-end cars have 80 miles of range. So it's not really smart, generally speaking, to put super fast chargers like these at stores. It's best to put them, like, right off the highway. But, you know, at least there's something to do, I guess, while you're waiting.
Yeah. And we're going to finish it up with just a quick news about the Audi e-tron Quattro, which is supposedly coming out later this year with the production version. What they did today is that they had like a weird press release about like putting the car in a Faraday cage and shooting lightning bolt on it, which is like just a big marketing stunt, really. But at the same time, in the press release, they announced that they confirmed a bunch of new specs, the main one being the expected range based on the WLTP standard. So, of course, if you remember, the e-tron Quattro was the first unveiled in 2015, and Audi was still using the NEDC standard, which, as we know, sucks. Just not accurate at all. Like, very few vehicles can get there, and normally you have to drive like a grandma to be able to get that that NEDC range. So now the WLTP that they are expecting... Where it is? Oh, yeah. 248 miles, 400 kilometers that they are expecting right now.
Right, and that's kind of on par with the Model X, which is it makes a lot of sense. Like the car is very similar size to the Model X, maybe a little bit smaller.
It's a bit smaller, yeah.
Yeah, so you know, a Model X P9 or 90D will get 250 miles. This is a 95 kilowatt power pack, and it's getting around the same. So,
yeah, I thought it would get a little more because of the fact that like it has like 5% more than 5% than the 90D, and it is smaller, so it should be like lighter. It should be a bit more aerodynamic.
Yeah, I was surprised at a little as well. I thought it would be better. It seemed kind of heavy though on that Nuremberg video we posted earlier. I think Audi just makes very heavy cars, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Maybe that's for safety or whatever, but this is kind of their first go, so they may have some more optimizations to do. But it is good to hear that they're getting the 150 kilowatt capacity of charging, which they've mentioned before. But you know, as things change, sometimes it's scary to see like, maybe it's 100 kilowatt now or something. But at least they're keeping that 150 kilowatt charging capacity.
It's a year before Porsche, which is all, of course, a partner of theirs. Gets with the 350, so it sounds like the 350 is not ready on the Porsche side, on the Volkswagen side, but they already are. 150 is already better than Tesla, so that's good news. It's gonna push the market forward on that front.
Yeah, do you think Tesla will up it before Audi comes out with it? Like when it's on the street, do you think Tesla will have something on the street as well?
I don't know. Like we've been talking since the beginning of the year that we feel like a little refresh might be coming soon.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible, but I'm not sure that they needed that. Like if they see them all the Quattro coming right now, they don't. Like Tesla is not worrying that much about Model X sales. I think like it's not a big issue for them. If they were, I think they'd go forward with it, but. Right now, they might be waiting for something else, I think. Other technology in order to make a bigger refresh to the car. I mean, I don't mean waiting for another competitor or something like that. But it's still great news, I think. And I think it might be a little bit price a little bit too high, but I think it could still sell pretty good.
I think it'll do fine. I think there's a lot of people who like Audi and interiors and exteriors that are gonna jump on this.
Yeah. Well, we managed to get through all of them with just being a little bit over time this time. But thanks a lot for tuning in, everyone, on YouTube and all your podcast app out there. Thanks a lot to our Patreon supporters, making it a lot easier for us to deliver the news every week and this podcast. Thanks a lot, and we're gonna see you next week. Bye.
Take it easy.